Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the president has announced a number of measures aimed at reining in the high cost of prescription drugs in the country. He's releasing a blueprint for bringing down the nation's high drug prices.
Well, the president's blueprint is focusing on a few key issues. Most notable among them is the high prices set by manufacturers. That is one of the key drivers of American healthcare costs. And clamping down on what he calls foreign governments, and this is a quote, free riding off of American innovation. Well, Mark, as we know, the drugs that are sold here at extremely high prices are much cheaper in other industrialized countries. So how he plans to exert control over those other countries and their prices will be extremely interesting to see.
One thing the president has said he would not do is to allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices, something that it's still barred by federal law from doing. The administration says it plans to create different incentives for addressing drug cost for Medicare recipients, including industry incentives for offering lower drug prices.
Well, this speaks to a number of changes that we see emerging across the healthcare landscape, and all of them are being touted as ways to rein in health costs. This includes the recent rise in so-called vertical mergers, large healthcare entities from different business sectors forming alliances. And that brings us to our guest today. Karen Lynch is president of Aetna, which plans to merge with CVS. The thinking behind this merger of the nation's largest pharmacy retail chain with a growing number of retail medical clinics and the nation's third largest insurer is that the two entities can work together to bring accessible health care into neighborhood settings, and they say that can help bring insurance costs down by facilitating more preventive care strategies and drug pricing strategies.
While analysts look at how that might actually play out for consumers, the $69 billion deal is still awaiting federal approval. At any rate, it'll be interesting to hear her thoughts on what this merger signals for the future of the larger insurers across the marketplace, many of whom are seeking similar types of partnerships and mergers. Looking forward to that interview, Margaret.
And Lori Robertson will stop by, the managing editor of factcheck.org, always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com or find us on iTunes.
And if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Karen Lynch, the president of Aetna, in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Another outbreak of Ebola in Africa. The outbreak recently confirmed in a remote village area of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Roughly 20 deaths so far. Unlike the epidemic in West Africa a few years ago, public health officials have quickly sprung into action to contain the threat. From 2014 to 2015, the Ebola epidemic spread across several West African countries, infecting almost 30,000 people, with more than 11,000 deaths, many of them frontline clinicians treating the outbreak. At the time, there was no infrastructure in place to treat the highly contagious and deadly pathogen. In the short time since that epidemic, scientists have created an Ebola vaccine that has proven effective in preventing infection, at least in the short term. They are rushing some 4,000 doses of the vaccine to the affected region. And medical response units are also being deployed to effectively contain the threat. Neighboring countries are also on high alert, screening people crossing the border from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The World Health Organization has issued a global call to end the use of trans fats in processed foods distributed around the world by 2023. Trans fats have been added to processed and snack foods for decades, but have since been identified as a key contributor to obesity, heart disease, and early death. The WHO believes the ban will save 500,000 lives per year. Drug prices are going to remain non-negotiable for the Medicare program for the time being. The president announcing plans to rein in the high cost of pharmaceutical prices, but skipped a key element that many observers felt was necessary, overriding federal policy preventing the Medicare program from negotiating drug prices for the tens of millions of seniors on the program. The president did single out pharmacy benefits managers, the so-called middlemen who negotiate drug prices between companies and payers. In all, the president's announcement didn't offer real concrete methods for bringing those prices down. Pharmaceutical stocks hiked up on the heels of the announcement. One in four Americans, meantime, has said they cannot afford the cost of their prescription drugs. And asthma control is hard to manage and even harder to track in real-time settings. But a recently completed study done in Louisville, Kentucky, shows that so-called smart inhalers may hold some promise. Researchers track the effectiveness of a device that can track where and when a rescue inhaler is being used. In the year-long study of more than 1,100 patients who were trained on how to use the electronic data gathering device, which is synced to their smartphones, it would track real-time activity and environmental data. What they found was pretty impressive. Over time, the smart devices led to a 78% drop in rescue inhaler use and a 48% increase in symptom-free days. The so-called AIR Louisville program also led to recommendations for how to improve health outcomes. In addition to the improved health outcomes for individuals, the study led to a number of recommendations for Louisville, which had been named one of the 20 most challenging cities for people with asthma. The study author suggests improved tree canopy, tree removal mitigation, zoning regulations to create air pollution buffers and new truck routes, and also suggested a creation of a community asthma notification system. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Karen Lynch, president of Aetna, where she oversees more than 22,000 employees in Aetna's commercial, government, and specialty business. Ms. Lynch joined the company in 2012 as executive vice president of local business. Prior to joining Aetna, she served as president of Magellan Health Services, a managed care company focused on behavioral health services. Before that, she served as president of dental services and several other leadership roles at Cigna. She was named to Fortune magazine's list of 50 most powerful women in business, as well as Modern Healthcare's top 25 women in healthcare. She earned her bachelor's degree in accounting from Boston College and her MBA from Boston University. Karen, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, it's a pleasure to join you both today.
Yeah, you know, we always seem to be at some crossroads or turbulence in healthcare, and you recently noted that if you want an indication of where healthcare is headed, you should look no further than your own company. And Aetna is one of the nation's largest health insurers and, like many other large industry stakeholders, has been engaged in a number of high-profile merger efforts. A recent and high-profile merger with the drugstore giant CVS appears poised to move forward, and it's almost $70 billion deal that most analysts agree signals a significant shift within the industry. And I'm wondering what this merger will mean for the healthcare industry as well as for America's health consumer.
Well, clearly this is a transformational merger, and it gives us the opportunity to reshape the healthcare industry. You know, the way I think about it, for too long and far too often, we've been practicing sick care, not health care, and the potential of a CVS-Aetna merger is really to organize around the consumer and around the consumer experience. It'll allow us to be in the local communities, to create another gateway to access health care, and it also give Americans a go-to destination for their healthcare services and their healthcare needs.
Well, Karen, I am sure that many health consumers are hoping that the proposed merger will lead to what you've said you hope will be a simpler, more affordable, and a more responsive consumer experience. And you've made the point clearly about the importance of meeting these consumers where they are in their neighborhoods and communities. You have close to 50 million health insurance customers. CVS, 10,000 stores across the country. I think most of us think every corner in America has a CVS, and operates even more of their walk-in clinics, quick care clinics in other locations. So share with us, how do you envision this merger on the ground facilitating improved access to care and healthier outcomes below getting the facilities there? What's going to fundamentally change within the services that are delivered?
Well, Margaret, you're absolutely right. CVS has over 10,000 stores across the United States, which means that 70% of Americans live within 5 miles of a CVS. And I think what's important to recognize, you know, how this will help facilitate improved access is really to understand what we've been saying for a long time now, that your zip code is more important than your genetic code. And what that means is your individual behaviors and your environment clearly have meaningful impact on healthcare costs. So I want you to imagine a local CVS being an interactive hub where individuals can come in and learn more about their health care, where they can access health care services, and they can have further assistance in navigating the overall health care systems, where we might point people to different providers, and more importantly, point them to social services in their communities to address the social determinants of care. And our overall goal is to achieve affordable, high-quality care for the individuals that we serve.
You know, I think cost is axiomatic with our healthcare system, a high cost system. 18% of the nation's GDP is spent in the healthcare area, and even small changes have a big impact on our country as well as the bottom line for many companies that succeed in leading healthcare in a more efficient direction. And your company is already forging into this new territory. Other entities are on the horizon: Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JP Morgan Chase partnership was announced recently. And wondering, how do we continue to support a robust healthcare industry that employs so many Americans while getting our arms around healthcare costs?
Well, what's interesting, Mark, is that we spend more on healthcare costs than any other country in the world, and research shows that Americans aren't getting any healthier. In 2025, healthcare costs will be at 25%. You mentioned 18% now. They'll be at 25% of the GDP. Wow. And as you can see, that's growing at an unsustainable rate. And that's the problem we're really trying to solve with this merger. You know, some key facts for you: that today, 30% of Americans suffer from diabetes. In the 1950s, it was less than 1%. 40% of adults today are considered obese. 20% of children are considered obese today, which you can imagine generates strain on our overall healthcare system. I think the other thing that you have to recognize with costs is over $900 billion, or $1 in $3, is waste in our healthcare system. And as I said earlier, we need to understand people's health ambitions, and we need to support them in their individual behaviors. We need to provide better access, and we need to give them more affordable and more transparent healthcare in America to really reshape and drive down overall healthcare costs.
Well, you know, Karen, we've also known the very good work of the Aetna Foundation for many years. And in fact, on the show not too long ago, we had Dr. Garth Graham. And he was speaking at the time about the Aetna Foundation's focus on impacting the social determinants of health. And he spoke about the partnership with U.S. News and World Report to create a ranking system to highlight the healthiest communities in the nation. The report's just come out. It's a data-rich resource for policymakers and public health advocates and data geeks like ourselves. But I'm really curious, how do you envision this data being used to improve outcomes around the country? How do you anticipate that you might be able to use this in the new Aetna-CVS merged corporation to address that basic fact that you said, that your zip code may matter as much as and sometimes more than your genetic code? And what would you suggest we might learn from communities that have gotten it right in addressing the social determinants of health?
Well, we couldn't be more excited about our partnership with U.S. News and World Report. This is a unique opportunity for us to partner with them. And as you mentioned, our report ranks communities across 10 categories, from education and public and health to infrastructure and economy. And it basically assesses which communities offer their citizens the greatest opportunity to lead a healthy lifestyle. And by forging this partnership, what we're expecting to do is, we're not just telling communities how they rank, we're providing them with ways to improve. And our hope is that we inspire every city and every county in America to have a healthy community agenda. And I think that's what will help, you know, support healthcare costs and, you know, help improve overall individual behaviors as we try to reckon with this unsustainable cost of healthcare.
We're speaking today with Karen Lynch, president of Aetna, where she oversees more than 22,000 employees in the Aetna commercial, government, and specialty business. Karen, I want to take a little deeper dive into that U.S. News and World Report, Healthy Communities Report, and it really does give credence to the observation, as you mentioned just earlier, that your zip code has more to do with your health than your genetic code. by creating a cultural change across communities is a heavy lift, and especially in areas that have a high level of poverty. We know, for instance, in Colorado, which has a very high ranking when it comes to health, due in part to government leadership, but it's also a state that supports healthy lifestyles. What can some of the communities that are struggling to help reduce these barriers do in the way of promoting better health?
So as you know, our goal is in creating the index is not just to recognize communities that are already making significant progress towards building their communities, but it's also to inspire that change to help communities think about and pursue improvements in overall public health. And as you both know, no communities are the same. And I think all communities can learn about the best practices in their own backyard and across the country and then apply those lessons to improve the health of their residents. So for example, you know, we've seen healthy gardens emerge in some underprivileged communities. We've seen increased bike paths, walkways, and I think that those are the important kinds of activities that need to occur. Our foundation has helped improve community health for more than 40 years, and it currently supports hundreds of programs across the country that address the social determinants of health. And our hope is that by using the data from the Healthiest Communities Index, the foundation will continue to make targeted investments in these programs, and our hope is that corporations will step up to the challenge in the local communities in which they work and live and support the healthy agenda.
Karen, I know that we've talked about the need for corporations to lead by example. We've talked about it within our own company. You've talked about it within Aetna, and that it's very important to create a culture within an organization that improves the well-being and the health of all who contribute to the company's mission. We read about your social compact in 2015 for the company's employees, offering everything from a higher minimum wage, which we think is so important, to lower out-of-pocket health care costs, to providing tuition reimbursement to help people advance in their career goals, which translates often into economic progress for their families. And you've even got a chief mindfulness officer at the company. Now, that's something we haven't thought about doing, but we might have to think about that. This is a wonderful nod to the need to recognize people are complex beings, and they bring that complex being to the workplace, and it has a real effect both on their work and their physical well-being. We're really curious to hear your thoughts about the impact of these programs on your workforce. Are you using any data to look at their effectiveness? Sounds like a great idea. Are you seeing any kind of tangible or qualitative outcomes that you could share with our listeners about what happens when a corporation makes these kinds of investments?
Yeah, we have seen tremendous progress. And just a reminder, in 2015, we increased minimum wage, as you noted, to $16 an hour. We also enhanced our overall medical benefits. And in 2017, we began making match loan payment contributions. And as you noted, we have mindfulness programs, including paying our employees to sleep more than 7 hours. And
that's
so
great.
I know, it's kind of fun. I wish I got 7 hours of sleep, but the result is that we have seen increased employee engagement, and we measure that on an annual basis. We've experienced overall increasing productivity across our employee population, and because our employees are what we consider happier and healthier and more productive, our customer satisfaction rates have also increased. So we're quite proud that we've been leading the way with our social compact, and we are seeing meaningful results with our employee population.
You know, Karen, let's take a moment and take a look at the regulatory environment, and certainly the current administration's shifting away from many of the Obama-era reforms put in place by the Affordable Care Act. We're seeing state insurance regulators struggling with some degree of uncertainty, and there's obviously compounded by actions of financial regulators. And yet, there's a growing momentum for more value-driven healthcare system. And wondering, how do you envision the health insurance industry forging new ways of doing business as the health policy landscape continues to shift? And where do you see the seam of opportunity in this shifting landscape?
Well, Mark, relative to the theme of opportunity, I would point to three areas. The first area is provider engagement, and really, and you mentioned it, driving to value-based care. As I think about it, you know, Aetna and providers have one common purpose, and that is truly to improve the quality and affordability of healthcare. And with value-based care, that demonstrates, you know, we can demonstrate that partnership to do just that. The second area I would point to is consumer engagement and being in the local communities and really focusing on individual behaviors and the social determinants of care. And I believe that that can be a very powerful step in reshaping how we think about healthcare. And the third thing I would mention is just focusing on holistic health, treating the whole person, both physical, emotional, and behavioral aspects of one's health. And I think that could make a meaningful difference on the impact of healthcare.
Well, you know, this is also interesting to think about. And I'd like to envision this expansion of the Aetna-CVS merger and ask you your thoughts about workforce, and particularly healthcare workforce. We are very engaged in postgraduate training of nurse practitioners and physicians and psychologists. We have an institute to train medical assistants. We educate RNs in primary care, just about everybody. But when I look at some of your comments and thoughts around these neighborhood-based CVS housed clinics, you're also talking about maybe having social workers out there or pharmacists. And I would imagine when you're thinking about social determinants of health, you've been thinking about navigators or community health workers. We all in healthcare struggle a lot to make sure we can find healthcare workers and that we have the appropriate training and education in place to meet the needs of the population we serve. So what keeps you and your colleagues up at night thinking about how you're going to recruit, develop, and retain the workforce for this expanded presence in the communities?
Well, that's a really great question, and I think that, you know, training our current workforce, you know, with the changing demands of using technology, will have a meaningful impact, number one. Number two is technology is really changing the way in which workers work today, and I think that we have to think beyond having people in the physical space and leveraging telehealth and telemedicine and having people have access in ways that are unique and different. And yes, of course, being in the neighborhood, you know, we expect to have pharmacists operate at the top of their license. We do expect to transform what a CVS store looks like and use nurses and health navigators. And at Aetna, we have thousands and thousands of nurses that are in the field and in the home, and we continue to recruit and train and educate those nurses to fulfill our promise of meeting people where they want to be met.
You know, I wanted to ask one final question about data. As much as you're a healthcare company, you're a data company. And we had Dr. Ashish Jha on the show from Harvard, who was talking about really not having lifetime actionable data, and that we're oftentimes grabbing Medicare data that's 2 years old. What are you doing at Aetna around the issues of giving the folks who are providing care access to more actionable and timely information?
A couple things. One, we are using cloud-based technology so that we have access to real-time data. We have nurses in the homes with iPads so that we can connect back into our systems. You know, obviously, you know, you talk about Medicare 2 years of data. You know, we've just built out a new app, Aetna Health app, that gives us real-time data. And I think that is a crucial aspect of how healthcare will transform, because having data at our fingertips will allow us to remotely monitor and get information about people where they are so that we can immediately get information back out to them. So for example, if, you know, I'm a runner, so if someone sees that I haven't been running in a few days, maybe I get an alert that says, hey, Karen, is everything okay?
Get going.
Or, you know, I envision a world where you might walk into a CVS and you might be a diabetic and, you know, we know you're there because of our geofencing, and you pick up a candy bar and it says, Margaret, that's not your next best action. I think that's where healthcare will be headed. And obviously, you know, in protecting information is critically important to that. But I do think that having real-time access can really change individual behaviors and how people think about their health.
We've been speaking today with Karen Lynch, president of Aetna. You can learn more about their work by going to Aetna.com or follow her on Twitter at Karen Lynch Aetna, as well as the company's Twitter handle at Aetna. Karen, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us, for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today, and we will look forward very much to following your progress.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The White House has proposed rescinding $7 billion in unspent funds from a children's health program. Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer said it would be, quote, taking money away from kids who need health care. But congressional budget experts say the number of individuals covered would not be affected. The main point of contention is the Trump administration's proposal to take $2 billion from a contingency fund used if states face both a shortfall and higher than expected enrollment in the Children's Health Insurance Program. CHIP, which is jointly funded by the federal government and the states, is for children and pregnant women in families with low incomes, but not low enough to qualify for Medicaid. Since fiscal 2009, when this contingency fund was established, three states, Iowa, Michigan, and Tennessee, have received payments from it, according to a 2018 report from the Congressional Research Service. The three states spent a total of $108.6 million in contingency funding. So the states haven't needed these funds much. Schumer's office argues that the funds could be needed in the future, and they are there in case of an emergency. Congress has rescinded unspent CHIP funds before, a total of $42.8 billion from fiscal year 2011 to fiscal 2017. In fiscal 2016, $1.7 billion was rescinded from the contingency fund for the first time. And earlier this year, a bipartisan omnibus spending bill rescinded nearly $2 billion from the fund. Schumer said at a press conference that he supported the omnibus rescission because the money was used to fund, quote, good things. But in this case, the Trump administration doesn't want to use the money for other things. And the budget watchdog group, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, says the money, quote, likely will not be used. The contingency fund should get a fresh influx of money up to $4.5 billion in fiscal 2019, which starts October 1st. Federal funding for CHIP will total $22.6 billion for 2019. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Wichita, Kansas nurse practitioner Michael Warzuski learned of the harsh and often fatal conditions that expectant mothers endure in sub-Saharan Africa, he thought there had to be a way to fill that need. He came up with a solution, Clinic in a Can, transforming shipping containers into fully equipped mobile clinics and operating rooms that can be shipped anywhere in the world where there is a need.
When you walk in the inside, you will think that you're inside your doctor's office, for which maybe you're an emergency room or an ICU unit. They look exactly the same.
Warzuski learned from his early iterations that gas-powered generators could be problematic in low-resource areas and switched all of his portable clinics to solar power, which he says was a game-changer.
There's no part of the world that does not have sunlight. And so solar power has become the cornerstone, so that now every piece of equipment, we can run it off of 500 watts of electricity, which means six solar panels on the top and eight batteries. is enough to run a clinic for 18 hours.
Since its founding a decade ago, clinics in a can have been delivered to war-torn Sudan, to earthquake-ravaged Haiti, and more recently to Santa Rosa, California, an area decimated by the wildfires that also destroyed the main community health center there. Santa Rosa Community Health Center CEO Naomi Fuchs says that the portable clinic provided a lifeline for her patients and was a godsend for her providers.
These are converted shipping containers that arrive fully equipped as a medical exam room. These have been an outstanding way to respond to emergencies and to set something up very quickly.
The roughly 120 square feet shipping container clinics are designed to support workflow and to become a permanent fixture in low resource areas.
A containerized clinic is something that's a turnkey. We equip it with the best equipment and we ship it as a completed project that once on the ground, within 20, 30 minutes, it's ready to be used.
Clinic in a can, a professionally outfitted shipping container fully equipped with medical and surgical equipment, solar-powered, providing quality, state-of-the-art medical facilities in a low-resource area. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.